Can you hear the group together and chatting? Hey, everybody. I'm Bill Radke with Erica C. Barnett, who writes for the CisForCrank.com. Jossie Ross, local writer, lawyer, activist, hands in the air. Bill Finkbeiner, former majority leader of your Washington State Senate. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And this is KUOW's Week in Review. So this week, Washington voters cast their ballots. There were a lot of big winners.
What a great message the 7th Congressional District is going to send when we elect the first woman in the district, the first person of color in the Democratic delegation, and the first South Asian American woman in Congress.
Pramila Jayapal there running for Jim McDermott's seat in Congress, and she got 40% of the vote, which put her in first place. There were also some losers.
Seattle's going through a lot of growth, and a lot of people put plans in place. Agree with them or not, this one was absolutely ridiculous.
Ridiculous, says Brian Screener, opponent of Initiative 123 to build an elevated park along the downtown waterfront. The initiative was crushed. 17% of Seattle voters went for it. Bill Finkbeiner, when you saw the results of the primary, you were thinking about the losers.
Yeah. You know, I've actually been thinking about that a lot this week and thinking about what the losers bring to our elections. There's always going to be somebody, who's willing to serve in an office. There's always going to be somebody that wants to be in charge. But it's really a big service that people add by being on the ballot and then losing. And,
why? What's that big service?
Well, because without that, there's no choice. Without that, there's no election and there's no way to keep control over the people in power, right? I mean, that's how the whole system works. So I think, like, even when we totally disagree with them, I think appreciating them. I was thinking on the way here, we should have a day after the election where it's just like Losers Appreciation Day.
Wow.
And
so you're talking about not just the people who thought they were going to win and fell short, but even the people who have no mathematical chance or no realistic chance.
I think Mike the Mover and Good Space Guy think on the day of the election, you know, this could be the year. I think everybody with their name on the ballot thinks they got a chance.
Are you speaking from experience?
Yes, I'm speaking from personal experience. 4 years ago, I stood up just a couple months from now. I stood up in front of 300 people after just 3 minutes ago looking at my phone going, oh, that was 6 months down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, now say something to everybody. And it's like, well, what am I supposed to say? It's a tough thing, and you leave a lot of yourself out there, and it's a great experience. I'd actually encourage more people to put their name on the ballot. Everybody should run for office at least once in their life.
Everybody should run for office at least once in their life.
That's scary.
Not me.
No?
Absolutely not.
Well, that's a good place for us to start, an unusual place for us to start. I want to just mention then one interesting loser before we go around the horn here, Bill. The state treasurer's race had Democrats losing. That doesn't happen often in a statewide race in Washington.
Well, even more ironically, the Democrats won in the sense that they got more total votes for Democratic candidates than the Republicans did. But because of our top two primary, the Republicans were the vote leaders, the two top two vote getters.
So, because there were fewer candidates to split up the vote?
There were three Democrats, each of whom got like 18%, almost equal, and then two Republicans got 22%. And so they were like 45, 46% of the vote, and those two are moving on to the general because they had the two top vote getters.
Is the state treasurer, though, is that even, does the party affiliation of that person matter? Is that a political office, or do they just balance the budget, add up the beans?
So I can tell you my personal opinion. I think we should just elect the person who's most qualified because it really doesn't have a lot to do with partisan politics. But I'll tell you the reality is that if you're a down ballot candidate, you are heavily influenced by your party affiliation. So it's very, they're Secretary of State, who's an incumbent, is in a very close race, and probably largely because of her party affiliation.
Okay. Erica, I think you disagree with me here, because what I thought about the primary, we've been marinating so much in Donald Trump and is our country coming apart and what's the Trump effect on local elections. And I somehow was surprised that the primary was so ordinary, that our legislature really didn't change, our Congress didn't change, incumbents won like they do, Seattleites voted to tax themselves as we always do, the Viaduct plan stays as it was. It's not especially hot this summer, not really rainy, seafair is happening. It's just, I was surprised how normal I felt, but you saw something more.
Well, I saw that. Well, in, to your point, Bill, I think that people didn't vote. And so that might be sort of a normalizing factor that people aren't really participating. That's typical for a primary. It's really more typical now that we have these ridiculously early August primaries.
Yeah.
But I do think that there were some important signs in this election. For one thing, there were a lot of women who are going forward to the general election. And I think, you know, my colleague over at Publicola, Josh Veit, called this the Hillary effect. And I think that in some ways, this is the year of the woman. I mean, you look at Pramila Jayapal doing incredibly well, I think better than expected in her race for Congress. You look at Lisa Wellman over in the 41st, which is a swing district that, you know, really is a Democratic district, but it has been held by a Republican, Steve Litzow, for a long time. And, you know, there's other examples as well. I mean, I think it's very Erin Jones in the school superintendent's race, Pat McCarthy. There's example after example of women surging forward. And I don't think that's a coincidence. And in our state, even though we are a very progressive state and we have had a female governor, we have two female senators, we have not been all that progressive in terms of electing women to the legislature, which is only about 30% female.
Do you think it's an effect of Hillary, or the cause is the same and it's all happening at the same time?
I think there's a couple of causes. One is that I think this is also, and this is a Hillary effect, I think this is also a very progressive and engaged electorate, even though it is a small electorate. I think that in many cases, the candidate who is perceived as the most progressive, or the candidates went through, I think the 7th Congressional District is a good example of that, where you had Pramila Jayapal going through. You also had Brady Walkinshaw, who is a young legislator who is considered, I think, more progressive than the guy he beat, Joe McDermott, and has a lot of support from young people, a lot of support from the gay community. So, you know, that's just one example. So I think there was a progressive element to it, too. But I do think that, you know, you can't just dismiss the fact that we have the first female presidential candidate in the United States history, and that, you know, down the ballot, we also see, at least in Washington, women winning at the lower down the ballot level. So I think there's something significant there. It's hard to tell exactly what's cause and effect.
Jesse Ross.
Yes.
You watched the same primary as the rest of us did.
I did.
What did you think of it?
You know, first and foremost, I think Erica mentioned it. The thing that struck me, first of all, was the boringness. She didn't mention that. But I thought it was everything according to form. You always follow the money, right? Usually the more well-moneyed candidates won. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that seems to be sort of a normative theme in all of our American elections, fortunately or unfortunately. You know, let the judgment be yours. The other thing was that I thought that, you know, there was this Joe McDermott, right? Joe McDermott. Like, that was the only thing that was interesting to me. Other than that, I didn't see any revolutionary thoughts. I saw some revolutionary thoughts, for example, out of Kansas. Kansas had an amazing referendum on what was considered the Sam Brownback school of conservatism.
Tea Party Republican.
That's right.
They turned their back on those folks.
Yes, election. They did. Very, very aggressively. And usually at the primary level, that doesn't happen simply because of turnout. Because, you know, 24% does not going to create a revolutionary thought. It's not going to change a trajectory midstream. But somehow in Kansas, that happened. That did not happen here, with one exception. And you asked me about it specifically. So since we're talking about effects and, you know, mm-hmm. whether or not those effects are real, I'll call it the Eddie Murphy effect, the distinguished gentleman effect. And so for the listeners who aren't familiar, I highly suggest, this is one of Eddie Murphy's funniest movies, and it was very slept on. I don't know why. It was kind of when he was like taking down from his 80s, you know, apex, but it was still hilarious.
Uh-huh.
And in that movie, he played a guy named William Jefferson Johnson, who was looking to replace the recently deceased Jeff Johnson.
And in Congress.
In Congress, yes. And so his tactic was...
He was a scammer.
Definitely. I mean, as some people might argue, a lot of our public officials are. and so he said, you know, he didn't have any substantive platform. His platform instead was, go with the name you know. And I see that effect, the Eddie Murphy effect, with possibly Joe McDermott being confused with Jim McDermott. Go with the name you know. So, yeah, that was, to me, the most interesting thing about this primary season.
Well, what if we left it there? And not only that, we ended with a little bit of poetry for the loser and then a little Eddie Murphy. Would you please share with us, Mr. Finkbeiner?
All right.
A veteran loser yourself?
Yes.
And winner.
And I want to go on the record real quick that I consider myself an interesting loser as well.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Good
Celebrate
group to be
that.
In.
That's right.
I'm with you, bro.
Yes. You're among compatriots.
Election winners are like geological events changing the landscape. We election losers are like snowflakes, each choosing a different path and form, but all arriving to the same place. We fall, we drift, we melt, and are forgotten.
Mm.
And it gets better from there.
It gets better after melting and being forgotten.
Not more of it, but it gets better from
there. All right, that's love for the loser. And now I give you the distinguished gentleman, Thomas Jefferson Johnson.
We're not going to show you Jeff Johnson waving a flag. We're not going to show you Jeff Johnson kissing babies. We're not going to show you Jeff Johnson doing anything because you already know what Jeff Johnson can do. Tomorrow, vote Jeff Johnson, the name you know.
That's not white enough?
That was very white.
Yeah, that's chilling, actually. I'm just scared myself.
It's KOW's Week in Review. We've got a lot more to cover. Stay tuned. KOW's Week in Review with some serious news to get to now with Bill Finkbeiner and Jossie Ross and Erica C. Barnett. Early Saturday morning in Mukilteo, a young man walked into a party full of college-age students, shot his ex-girlfriend and three young men. Anna Bui, Jake Long, Jordan Ebner were killed. Will Kramer was wounded. This is Washington State's fifth mass shooting this year. The shooter says he bought the AR-15 semi-automatic rifle about a week before the murders and that he was motivated by jealousy over his ex-girlfriend. Erica, this shooting has you thinking about what we don't discuss.
We discuss, when mass shootings happen, we discuss terrorism and we discuss mentally ill people as if those are always related to mass shootings. What we don't discuss is domestic violence, which is the best predictor of mass shootings. And you can look at it in a couple ways. Domestic violence usually precedes any kind of violence. There are usually signs that a person is going to behave violently, and those signs are that he has behaved violently before. If you look at mass shootings themselves, which, you know, if you define it as four or more people shot, the majority involve a current or a former intimate family member, something like 80%. And so we're talking about intimate, usually, killings that happen often inside the home in private spaces. And they're so commonplace that we don't talk about them. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, that we don't talk about them as well. I think violence against women is not taken seriously in our culture, and it's not something that we want to deal with. But this was a domestic violence shooting, and it happened at a party. But all of the signs and the hallmarks are there of a lot of these other shootings, like the Orlando shooting. The shooter in that case had abused his former wife. And, you know, we can go on and on. Robert Deer, the Planned Parenthood in Colorado, same thing. He had a history of domestic abuse. And so I think if we want to prevent mass shootings and shootings in general in the future, the thing to look at is has this person been convicted of domestic violence? Have they had a domestic violence order taken out against them? And those people shouldn't be able to have guns. That will do a lot more than taking guns away from people on the terrorist watch list, from cracking down and further stigmatizing the mentally ill, who are much more likely to be the victims of violence than they are to commit acts of violence. And I think it would actually be effective, but it would require a lot of changes, not just in society, but in our attitudes towards women, and then just doing these simplistic solutions that don't actually do anything.
Couple of questions. Do you know this Mukilteo shooter's history of violence?
I don't. Okay. That has not come out yet. The thing that has come out is that the police are investigating it as a domestic violence shooting specifically.
Right. And so why do you think that we wouldn't want to recognize, talk about, deal with domestic violence?
I think we live in a culture where, I mean, to be frank, women and children are seen as possessions of men to a certain extent still, you know, and I think we live in a culture of very toxic masculinity, which is a type of masculinity that privileges, you know, that sort of says you're better if you're tougher and don't show your feelings and everything that is womanly is weak and bad. And it's terrible for men. But I also think that it's terrible for women because we see domestic disputes as merely being, you know, internal private matters not to be talked about. And it's really hard to get a restraining order. It's really hard to get it taken seriously. Most cases of domestic violence aren't even reported because the cops historically haven't taken it seriously. I mean, it hasn't been that long that women were considered chattel. So it's not surprising that we still have attitudes towards domestic violence that are different than attitudes towards public violence.
So what would be the model if we talked about, thought about, dealt with domestic violence seriously? What that would look like, what could we compare that to that we do recognize and address? I've heard someone say the flu, for example, that everybody knows you go get your shot and everybody knows what quarantines are and wash your hands and it's not in the shadows.
I think we would take seriously the notion that we need background checks for people. I think we would do background checks for domestic violence convictions as well as domestic violence restraining orders. A lot of times you can't get
talking about gun background.
I'm talking about guns, yes. And so for example, if I get a restraining order against a guy who is being abusive to me, the guy can still get a gun in between me getting a temporary restraining order and a permanent restraining order. And that is the most dangerous period for a woman. So or man, but some for a victim of domestic violence is between that temporary and that permanent restraining order. And in some cases, you can still get a gun after a permanent restraining order. It's state by state. I think that should not be allowed. And I think we should have background checks. And, you know, and a lot of the solutions that I think would work for gun violence or help with gun violence more generally, just making it harder for everybody to get guns, you know, so that you can't walk into the store down the street and have a gun that same day, you know, an AR-15 or, you know, whatever kind of military style assault rifles are being used in these heinous acts.
Jossie, you also think that gender plays a role in how we treat domestic violence as a crime, as a problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We, I think Erica said it, you know, amazingly succinct and you know, it's tragic. The way the even restraining orders are structured, where federal law doesn't do anything to restrict gun ownership until after that initial temporary restraining order is filed and completed. So there's this whole period of time that where a person is incredibly vulnerable to retaliation, and that's a matter of empirical data. And so it's not until after that time where there's actually going to be some level of scrutiny to that person purchasing a gun. So you have this person who's angered, who's looking for revenge, I mean, theoretically, and has that whole period of time to plot and scheme. But that's even sort of getting ahead of ourselves, because the process of getting a restraining order in the first place, well, I disagree to some small degree that I think it is generally on a legal mechanical level fairly easy to access the temporary restraining order. The psychology of abuse is one that requires a person who hasn't taken these sort of affirmative steps and who is being abused to do things that are completely outside the nature of that relationship. And so it's just innately dangerous and it's innately counterintuitive for that person. And I think the way the laws themselves are structured are definitely from a male normative perspective that says we're not going to do field testing, for example, that there's going to be certain things that are going to be considered, that are going to be obstacles for a person seeking the protection of a temporary restraining order in the first place.
As to how much we talk about domestic violence, Bill Finkbeiner, we were just starting to have this conversation and didn't finish it, so I want to find out what you mean. You had said something about that there's concern that when we talk about something more, we might encourage it. Is that relevant to this topic?
No, I think that was more on the terrorism thing, because I think that, you know, the more we talk about terrorism and random shootings, the more we forget that most violence is not random. It's, you know, it's much more likely the shootings and you're likely being shot, likelihood of being shot or kidnapped or all these other things is much more likely to be, you know, somebody that you know, that you have a relationship with. So I think getting to this conversation about how do we address that, obviously terrorism's an issue, but I feel like that, you know, it just sucks all the oxygen in the room a lot of times and gets all of the focus. And the reality is, if we're concerned about, you know, making our world a safer place, we'd be talking about these issues more and that issue less.
And I just want to correct one stat that I just said. It's more than half of mass shootings involve an intimate partner. It's 80% of those shootings that involve that are shootings of a woman or child.
Yeah. And just on that thought, there was a stat that said that from 98 to 2008, that 40% of female homicide victims were killed by either a former or current intimate partner. And so, as Erica said, absolutely correctly and brilliantly, the whole theater that happened in June with John Lewis, the sit-in and stuff like that, it was like, okay, yeah, you're attacking the capillaries. You know, but if you
talking about the congressional filibuster,
that's right.
Thing, yeah,
but there are certain empirical indicators. One is domestic violence. The other is violent misdemeanors. Those two things account for a huge portion of the instances of shootings and mass shootings. And so, if Congress, our lawmakers, actually want to do something, those two little blind spots are the areas that they would truly attack. Not saying they can't run collateral, but they're just completely missing the mark on those two points.
So finally, we've mostly been talking about the law, but Eric, I wanted to underline something that you got me thinking about, this idea of just what we pay attention to and what we talk about, how little we talk about, especially men's triggers, you know, about possessiveness, about why we're violent. And just think about how little of daily life that conversation happens compared with how it tears us apart when it flares. You know, isn't that, it just sort of got, when you were talking, I was thinking, isn't that amazing how little how much we talk about some things and how little we talk about others?
Yeah. And one of the things that, as you mentioned, one of the reasons that's being speculated for the shooting is this guy was jealous that another guy was, I mean, not even necessarily dating this woman, that she was with another guy. And that's that possessiveness,
yeah.
I think, is something, and that entitlement is something that we ingrain into boys from a very young age. And you see it in culture, you see it in parenting, you see it, you know, in just every aspect of boys and girls' lives. And I think it's really tragic that we don't, you know, on the one hand, treat girls and women as fully human and fully autonomous people, but also that we treat boys in such a way that, you know, we tell them they're no good unless they get the girl, they get the thing, they're the strongest, they're the biggest. And I think that's a huge tragedy that we don't talk about enough when we talk about parenting, when we talk about education, when we talk about, you know, the culture that we consume. It's just kind of background noise that, you know, the plot of every, you know, romantic comedy is trying to get the girl. And that's a really, you know, innocuous version of that. So I think that it is something that we need to talk about more is, you know, can you be a man without having this, you know, without accumulating possessions and, you know, and women being one of those possessions? Can you be a man without overly, you know, excessively disciplining your children? I mean, can men have some of those more traditionally feminine characteristics? And I think that they should, and they would be a lot happier. So that to me is something that we need to talk about more in our culture on every level.
Well, things can change, and that's why we bother talking about what something that happened and trying to get underneath what was this really about and how could we change. So the KUW's Week in Review is going to continue. Back to the news and more when we continue. K KUOW's Week in Review with Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate, Jossie Ross, writer, lawyer, activist. Erica C. Barnett writes for the C is for Crank.com, and we're trying to learn something from the news of this week. This next story is about who gives money to politicians and when politicians ought to give that money back. Democrats in the Olympia area got a $50,000 donation, by far their biggest donation this year, from a spiritual teacher named J.Z. Knight. J.Z. Knight is best known for channeling a 35,000-year-old warrior spirit named Ramtha, who appears to be bigoted against Catholics, Jews, gay people. Here's a bit of Ramtha discussing Mexican immigrants.
The invasion of the Mexicans who just breed like rabbits, they're poison.
Washington State Democrats took $70,000 in donations from J.Z. Knight and gave it to charity. But Thurston County Democrats have a different take on it. The chair of the Thurston County Democrats, Katie Nelson, says J.Z. Knight is a member of the community and so are the people who belong to her organization.
They share the same values as the Democratic Party, the Thurston County Democrats. So we accepted their donation like we would any other donation from an organization that believes in our values.
Bill Finkbeiner, you've run a campaign. You've taken donations. How much vetting of a donor do you do before you take their money?
I can tell you this. When it's a $70,000 or $50,000 check, they know exactly who it's coming from. You know, this what used to be a big issue when I was running more with the tobacco companies. And so I remember getting a donation from Kraft, who at the time owned Philip Morris, and really struggling with it, you know. It's there's just, you know, there's a lot of sort of competing interests when you're running a campaign, one of which is that it, you know, money helps win elections. At the same time, you know, there's the fact that at the time the press was really doing a good job letting people know when this is happening and who people are getting money from and that sort of thing.
At the time.
Yeah.
More so than now.
I'll say two things. One, I ended up giving it to charity, which was, I'll say, a little easier for me at the time because it was a pretty easy race, so I wasn't too concerned about it. It would have been harder if it was a harder race. But I'll say it used to be that there were you know, 10 times as many press people covering the elections as there are today. And one of the real problems that I think we have is there's a lot of people giving money for a lot of reasons, and the coverage is just so much less. Our you know, the press has been stretched so thin. And their ability to do this kind of journalism is tough. So I think the real question to ask, along with what are they going to do with the money, is why did she give it, right? I mean, you have to assume that Ramtha has a lot of money, partly because she doesn't just totally blow it on stuff. And so there's a reason she wrote $120,000 worth of checks. And I'd be real curious of what that reason is. And maybe it's because she agrees with the principles of the Democratic Party. Maybe there's something else that she would like some help on in the government, and that's you know, and that's why she wrote the check. I think it's important to find those things out, and I wish that we had you know, the same coverage that we've had in the past on that stuff.
Well, we have less newspaper beat reporter coverage, but we also, in a way, have more coverage of everything. We happen to have somebody right here who covers elections a whole bunch at the CSforCrank.com. Erica C., should the Democrats return the money?
Well, to Bill's point, real briefly, I think you're absolutely right. There's not enough journalists in Olympia, and I'm a part-time journalist, and I can't cover this stuff, and this was new to me. I had no idea. When I heard this, I was like, you've got to be kidding. I mean, of course they should return the money. It's obviously something that's coming with strings attached. It makes them look bad, and there's a price to that, too. I mean, I don't know how much of a story this is down in Olympia, but when I saw it, I just thought, I mean, absolutely no question that you would return that money because you look tainted and it just looks terrible. And it gives the Republicans, you know, a sort of entry point to say, well, you know, obviously the Democrats will take money from anybody and we wouldn't do that, which I believe Susan Hutchison, the head of the Republican Party, has said.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you need to, in some cases, hold the moral high ground, even when it is a $50,000 check, which I think is something like half of their budget. But right. That means she controls half of their budget,
yep,
in a way.
Jossie, who's right?
Oh, I mean,
should they give the money back?
I don't. There's two different questions. There's one: is it hypocritical with Democratic values? That's a separate question from when should you give it back. because there is such a thing as using some money for a positive end, right? That comes from a tainted tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you take that money and say, we're going to take the money away from that person's got less money now. We're going to mm-hmm. put it to good.
Yeah. I mean, there is an argument for that. But the question regarding whether it's hypocritical, whether it's racist, whether it's insensitive, whether it's sexist, anti-Semitic, is absolutely unabashedly yes. I mean, the Democratic Party is in a position with their pants down in Thurston County, and they should be held accountable for that. So the question becomes, what are you going to do with that money? We understand you have bills to pay, et cetera, et cetera. If they were smart, and I'm not quite positive they're smart based upon their response, but if they were smart, they might say something like, we are going to donate this because we understand that this is really horrible thing that this 30,000-year-old spirit, this 30,000-year-old spirit has a really, really acute awareness of international borders, right?
Yeah.
They're really smart about current day geography. Mm-hmm. But you know, maybe that's the wisdom of 30,000 years. But this person, this you know,
Democrat. You're not alive for 35,000 years and learn nothing.
Right. No, exactly. They could probably do really well at Jeopardy. No. I watch Groundhog's Day. You know, like, we're going to take this money and we're going to donate it to the Anti-Defamation League or something like that. But Democrats, we need you as a symbol, you know, of coming in on your behalf of this noble gesture to match that money that we're otherwise poorer as a result of. If they were wise and savvy, once again, based upon this response, I'm not sure that they're particularly smart, but I think that there is a way to play it where they could actually have the moral high ground that Erica spoke about, but also have some money.
I think that when they say, I
like to have moral high ground and money.
Have some money.
Yeah.
I think that when they say that they are, that these people reflect their values, not knowing anything necessarily about the people who are members of this church, but definitely knowing that she is out there, that the leader of this church or whatever it is out there saying that, you know, saying anti-Semitic things and saying things that are horribly racist against immigrants. Those are the values that they're familiar with. So you should not be on the radio saying that those are your values. And I mean, it just really, to me, would make me worry that the Republican Party, if they're smart, which, you know, is also questionable, would use that as, you know, as a soundbite. Now, it becomes a little trickier when your presidential candidate is also a notorious racist and anti-Semite in some ways. So maybe they're not going to take that opportunity because then they would look hypocritical. But, you know, I'm not sure. I agree with Jossie. I'm not sure that they are terribly smart.
Well, to be fair, the donor was only channeling a racist. So maybe the audience was just saying, you know, even Ramtha gets it wrong sometimes.
You know, Donald Trump could probably play the channeling response. Like, man, I've been possessed these last 6 months.
KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, Jossie Ross, Bill Finkbeiner, Erica C. Barnett. Your fall ballot will include a $54 billion measure to expand light rail around the Sound. On your ballot, you will see the argument for the Sound Transit 3 measure and the argument against. The controversy here is over who gets to write that anti-Sound Transit argument. The way our law works, the Board of Sound Transit got to choose who will author that no vote argument on the ballot, and they picked Washington's most famous or infamous tax opponent, Tim Iman. Iman doesn't represent all the opposition to Sound Transit 3. There are organized groups who say, wait a second, Iman is really unpopular. Voters know him as the anti-tax guy, and in this area, they don't like him. We have other problems with Sound Transit 3 besides it being a tax increase. Let us make our own argument. Former lawmaker Bill Finkbeiner, first of all, do you think Sound Transit's choice of Tim Iman is even going to win them votes? Will it win votes for Sound Transit?
Oh, I don't think it's a mistake that they picked him. I think that he brings, as soon as you put Tim Iman's name under any argument in the voters' pamphlet, especially in the boundaries within Sound Transit, you're dragging it down. And you know, is it 3%, 2%, one, who knows? But it's there's clearly a lot of people who are gonna discount what he says. I really think they should have. Well, first of all, the legislature should have not given the people putting the proposition on the ballot the ability to choose the person who writes against it. And I was probably there when we did that, so that was a screw up.
But thanks a lot, Finkbeiner.
Exactly,
Finkbeiner.
It's a long list, Bill. But then also, you know, I think they should have picked the organized opposition, and they should have gone out to there's groups that are organized that are making the cases. Again, just like the case I was making about having losers in elections, you need good arguments on both sides for the system to work, and you want the best no argument to be on that ballot along with the best yes argument, and they should have picked somebody else.
Erica C., is this a kind of savvy sabotage?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Sound Transit wants the best people on the no side. So I think that, you know, good on them. They're allowed to do it. And if they want this thing to pass, I think this is a very clever and, yeah, savvy move. I mean, I think it's obviously political. It's pretty nakedly political. And, you know, but on the other hand, Tim Iman is the longest tenured opponent of Sound Transit, probably out there, outside of maybe Maggie Femia, who I believe is involved in one of the groups that's opposed to the measure also that's going to be represented on the ballot. So it's not just Tim Iman. It's a couple of other people, I believe.
Yes.
And so, you know, he is associated with opposing Sound Transit. He's the guy who's always running initiatives to try to, you know, lower our car taxes and lower our car tabs. And that's all intimately related to Sound Transit. So at the same time, I mean, there is a legitimate argument. There's plausible deniability there, I think, for Sound Transit to say, well, no, this guy's been doing this forever. So, of course, he's the expert.
Well, that's the pragmatism, Erica C. But if you're king of the world, do you let Sound Transit pick Tim Iman as the no vote?
Well, what's the alternative? Letting the legislature do it? I mean, just making it a free-for-all where anybody who wants to could get there first and write the ballot measure? I mean, I'm assuming that the legislature had some reason for picking Sound Transit as the agency that would pick the no campaign. So I would turn
What
it
about
over.
The Secretary of State's office?
Mm-hmm.
You're outside my depth there. I don't know that the Secretary of State's office would necessarily have the expertise on every single local ballot measure that happens in the state of Washington to know who the best representatives for each side would be. So that seems like it could be something of a slippery slope. So I mean, if there's another alternative that's out there, you know, I could see from, you know, if I'm king of the world, you know, and maybe this makes more sense for democracy, but I'm not seeing an alternative other than the way that we currently have it being put on the table.
Jossie, I ask you again, who's right?
You know, I just have questions. I have factual questions about this. You know, what was the process for, if it's a paid position, you know.
It's not.
Okay. I mean, that's important. Whether, you know, taxpayer resources are going to it. Otherwise, I think it's a pretty savvy move. I mean, I think it's definitely one that you can see through. But if you're trying to, you know, kind of force it through, I'm not mad at, you know.
Hey, if you're trying to force it through.
Which, yeah.
I mean let's just say theoretically it's not democratic.
Right. And they're using the process, which lawmakers are not necessarily averse to, using the process in a way that, you know, might be seemed, you know, slightly, you know, off base, but is definitely legal. It's ethical. It passes. You know, the money is a big question for me. And if it's unpaid, I don't have a huge problem with
it. I don't think it hinges on whether Tim Iman is on the ballot or on the voter's guide. Frankly, I think that I don't know. It's a long way off somewhat still. But I mean, I think Sound Transit is polling really well. I don't think it's like, you know, we have to do this or otherwise we're going to lose. I think it's just kind of sticking a finger in the opponent's face.
All the more reason not to do it then, right? I mean, if you feel comfortable.
Oh, come on. You've run elections. You know how much fun that is.
Yeah. You know, I want to pause you there because sticking fingers in your face is something we're going to talk about coming up on KOW's Week in Review. Yeah, to some people, that was the story of the week. Coming up, the floss. And that's not all. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. It's Erica C. Barnett and Bill Finkbeiner and Jossie Ross. And I'm Bill Radke. Maybe you will get excited when I say the word hydroplanes.
Oh, God.
Or maybe not. Maybe you're not listening anymore because you think you know everything about the hydros and you don't care. I'm sympathetic, but listen up. The hydroplanes, they run on Lake Washington every August, part of Seafair. And in old Seattle, through the 50s, early 60s, the hydros were everything here.
This is before the Space Needle was built. This is before we were famous for coffee and computing. And it was something that we could take pride in because we made it here. The racers lived here. This was our community. This was our sport. And by gosh, we were the best in the world.
That's Leonard Garfield of the Museum of History and Industry describing the time when Seattle adored its hydroplane races. The Gold Cup was happening in Detroit at the time. There were powerboats, but it was this Boeing engineer and his friends who engineered a super fast boat with a surplus World War II fighter jet engine. So it was Seattle Maritime meets Seattle Aerospace, and we kicked their butts. And all of a sudden, the center of fast boats was Seattle way back then. So, Jossie, there are a lot of new locals listening. Can you make a case for loving the hydros today?
Yeah, because a lot of the locals have a lot of money, and you probably have a yacht. So, you know, go out there, hang out on the boat, but us normal peons, you know, will be watching you on the water, getting your tans and drinking champagne. No, I'm playing. Of course, I'll be a facetious.
The true part of it, I drove on I-90 today.
Yeah.
There's yachts lined up.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Already, yeah. So it's not like.
It's an incredibly, you know, unfortunately, the way it played out, at one time there was probably a portion that was very altruistic. But now in 2016, Seattle is pretty antithetical to eco-friendly Seattle, where we're going to go burn off a bunch of gas, you know, flying these blue angels in the sky and hydroplanes and extremely classist, that where the average person or even slightly above average person, because the median income in Seattle is pretty high, still can't get any sort of bird's eye view of the festivities. So enjoy your yachts, enjoy your champagne, and realize that a whole bunch of us are going to be home watching Teen Titans Go because we can't see it.
At Twitter, a listener named Jeff says, "We don't have the piston-powered boats anymore. They were a treat to the senses. The throbbing motor sounds would carry for miles." So that's the thing. They're not really thunderboats anymore because we've got quieter turbines now. Bill Finkbeiner?
Well,
are they still lovable? Can we make a case?
I love it every year. I love it for the Blue Angels. I always think, you know, if over my entire lifetime, my cumulative tax, you know, amount that goes to the federal government, if that pays for one Blue Angel to fly from the south end of Lake Washington to the north end, it was worth it. It was worth it.
Is it if I have to ask why you love the Blue Angels so much, I will never understand, right?
I think it is. It's like it's a feeling you get in your gut when you see those fly over, and some people makes them want to puke, and the other people makes them want to cheer. I love it. I can watch those guys. I just think it's a feat of engineering. I just think it's just an absolute. It's, you know, it's incredible. It's like the Northern Lights. It's just amazing. Those things can move that fast.
So you flipped that upside down. We went from the hydros that are hard to see to the planes that at least that's democratic. Erica C., do you care? Should we care?
I mean, I watch the Blue Angels every year. I think I was on last year defending them.
Oh.
And I really do enjoy the air show tremendously. It allows me to see something really cool for free. My dad's a pilot, a small plane pilot, so it gives us something to talk about every year, which is cool. Never seen the hydros. Maybe, Jossie, maybe that's why. I guess I've just never even thought about going to see them because...
You can't.
Okay. Well, yeah, no one's ever invited me. I've lived here 15 years and more than 15 years now. And, you know, I don't have any fond associations of the 1950s. And I think if we're going to get... nostalgia, I mean, of the 1950s anywhere, but I don't have any fond, you know, 40-year-old thoughts about Seattle... I think if that's the reasoning for getting all excited about the Blue Angels about the hydroplanes, then yeah, it's going to die out because we're in a different city now and our economy isn't based primarily in aerospace and the maritime economy anymore. And that's what happens in cities. They change. And so we have a different economy now, and that's fine. We had a different economy in the 1950s than they had around the turn of the century, too.
We should have a parade of engineers coding
while
they're on the back of the truck. That would be very apropos to Seattle right now.
The torch type parade. The people typing along, and we can all watch them do amazing things on their keyboards. So did you ever go out and float on the lake?
Oh, no, not float on the lake. I mean, I participated. We used to have the the Discovery Park powwow during the same, you know, during the same time. Everything kind of coincided at one time, and then things got separated because nonprofits, United Indians of All Tribes Foundation, it was a bad time for nonprofits, so they didn't get proper funding for the powwows and stuff, so things kind of trailed off. And at one time, when Seattle was a different place, it was kind of homegrown. It was kind of grassroots. And I wanted to specifically give a shout out to the Emoja Fest, which is happening at Judkins Park this weekend. And if folks want to see something that is grassroots, they should go up there. There's local music, local food, local vendors, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, at one time I enjoyed it. But like many parts of Seattle, it kind of lost its Seattle. And I don't really recognize it anymore.
Do you have any tips then? Bill, you say you've got some experience. I'm going out for the first time. Somebody invited me. Somebody's got a boat. I'm going out on Lake Washington.
Aren't you fancy?
I don't know what I'm not fancy. I have cargo shorts. That's another topic that was big this week. But I haven't done it. And is there any guide to me having fun, and as opposed to
have
being
fun.
Trapped?
You know, I
haven't
been out there
sunshine.
For 20 years. Okay. The air show is what I remember. I mean, it's not just the Blue Angels; it's all the rest of them. The boats are amazing, but after the fourth time they go around, it's sort of.
Is that why people are drinking? I don't understand.
Yeah.
What's the big deal with the drinking?
That might be.
It sounds like it's this parade extravaganza of fun. Like, do you drink it at an amusement park? Why are people pounding back alcohol? If they're on a boat. Yeah, there's something about it. That's it, right? It's like there's something on a boat that's your time to turn it up to 11 and tell yourself you're a crazy rich party animal. It's like that. Remember the SNL spoof on the yacht? You know, I'm on a boat. Look at me, I'm on a boat. No, nobody.
I don't remember that. No.
I got my swim trunks and my flippy floppies. There's something, you just feel like the king of the world. And I guess you're entitled to drink, I guess.
It just makes me want to jump in the water.
Well, I'll have to jump in the water because there's no bathroom on this boat. And apparently that's a big part of seafaring. Okay, with that in mind, with the lack of sanitation in mind, we're going to talk about your mouth in a moment on the Week in Review.
Great.
Okay, on KOW's Week in Review, we've covered so much news this hour, but we haven't mentioned what to many people was the story of the week.
This may surprise you. All those years that you've been flossing, it may not have done you any good.
Public Health England says it will review its guidance on dental flossing after research in the Netherlands suggested it may not prevent gum disease, plaque, or cavities.
Flossing is really gross.
Do you floss regularly?
You know, I do, but it's not my favorite thing to do.
To use crude language, Kelly, dentists say that this is basically the dumbest thing ever.
This week, the federal government dropped its recommendation that you floss every day, and that's because the effectiveness of flossing has not been scientifically established. KOW's Twitter followers told us they were dancing with joy. Why would it be good news that you have one less proven tool against tooth and gum disease?
Because they're nasty.
What's nasty?
The gum disease? People, the listeners, the people who don't want to floss. They're nasty. I mean, it does change your breath, and it changed the amount of stuff that you have in your teeth. Whether or not it's scientifically proven, I'm going to take my chances. You know, I don't want those things in my teeth. I don't see the cause for celebration, even if it is just a myth. I like that myth. I'm cool with Santa Claus.
You know what's so weird? Like, 2 days before this news came out, I listened to a podcast called Surprisingly Awesome, which is a really good podcast if you're not listening to it. Anyway, a little buzz marking, and I'm not associated with it at all.
Okay.
But anyway, it was about flossing, and the doctor on that show said that something like 96% of people have gum disease, and this good doctor maybe has changed her mind, but what she said was that flossing is absolutely critical, and your dentist can tell if you haven't been flossing.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you are motivated by shame, if not motivated by bad breath, I think you should keep flossing, and I'm saying this as—
Or avoid your dentist.
Or, well, I do that, for sure. But I'm saying this as someone who feels like I am a better person, I'm a better American, I'm a better citizen now that I've finally gotten on the flossing train and I am a religious flosser myself.
It took you a while?
It's a pain in the butt.
Was it
those new things, annoying.
Where they got the little piece already
piece of plastic and you hold it?
Yeah. No, I use the unwaxed kind as my dentist recommended, but I just felt kind of pathetic that I couldn't do this one stupid little thing every day.
Well, that's part of it. Some people do it wrong. It's easy to saw back and forth, but what you should be doing is doing the up down, flipping it out and all that. Maybe that's more than you want to think about the food in your mouth. Maybe that it's part psychological. I don't know.
Flossing is just it's part of the discipline. I mean, there's certain things that I think we take on faith. I mean, it may not have the, magical elixir values that we were taught as little kids, but what does it hurt?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the question. And so, folks, there was this product, completely off subject, but it was called Olestra. Olean.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that.
Yeah,
it was nasty.
The fake fat in
chips. And it said that you can eat all these potato chips and cookies and all this stuff and not gain weight. Usually when stuff it sounds too good to be true, there's no pain involved.
Yeah.
Like, no, it is too good to be true. And to me, this strikes me. The FDA also approved the use of Oxycontins for kids 12 and under last year. They also approved this Frankenfish, this genetically modified salmon. I'm not really trusting them right now.
Okay. Well, interesting. On Twitter, Casey says, if you have ever flossed your teeth, you've seen the gunk, you know flossing is effective. And it turns out, the original story was misleading. We don't have the long, rigorous, independent scientific studies that prove the flossing case, but that might be because it's expensive and maybe unethical to have huge numbers of people never floss for decades to see what happens. Seattle dentist Dr. George Knudsen told me it may not be scientifically established, but the benefits of flossing are obvious, especially for gum disease. Knudsen says there are a few of us who are genetically lucky enough to stay healthy without flossing.
But as specialists, especially the dental hygienist, my God, what have you done to them? They have to deal with this, every 6 months, and with people with disease every 3 months.
He said this news this week is rubbish, and many other dentists are echoing this, that saying flossing, it does help fight disease, which for some reason will make us sad, apparently, for reasons I don't fully understand.
I think you guys might be part of the dental industrial complex.
You think so?
Because the other thing
that's
I read
right, I'm part of Big Flaw. I'm part of Big Glide. And I'm making major coin.
Weren't most of the studies that were out there, or at least most of the claims, were all people who made dental floss were putting all those out, right?
Well, who else is going to study it?
Yeah, well.
There's that. And I want to thank Renee, who on Twitter says, I've told friends for years, next time you floss, smell it. That's what your breath smells like. If you don't like the smell, floss more. That's what Renee has told friends for years.
Oh,
just
I
take
hate
it on
everything
faith.
About that.
Yeah, I know.
Renee's friends, by the way, have been crazy busy lately and not able to get together with Renee as much as they would like to.
I'm not going
to
smell it, Renee. I just floss.
KOW's Week in Review. Jossie Ross, Bill Finkbeiner, Erica C. Barnett, C is for crank.com. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Feel like I've left you on. You look ill. Are you okay?
I'm just not going to be able to get that tweet out of my mind for a while.
Just look forward to the Blue Angels. Be out there in half hour.
That's right. Blue Angels coming up. Let's clear our palate and do it again afresh next time, okay? Thanks for tuning in, everybody.